Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Yaron Brooks Show. Yaron is out this week, and so I'll be filling in for him. My name is Rituparna Basu. I'm Yaron's colleague here at the Ayn Rand Institute, and we'll have a good show today. So where is Yaron, you might be asking, you might be thinking. I think he's been away for a few weeks now. I'm not sure the last time that he hosted this radio show. But Yaron is in Europe. Yaron is all over Europe, actually. He has already been in Sweden, in Denmark. You have to forgive me because they're a little bit ahead the time difference. So Sweden, Denmark, Yaron's in Oxford tomorrow, Sunday. He's in Oxford. He's in Exeter. He's in Cambridge. He's in London. So if we have some Yaron Brooks Show listeners who are in England, you definitely need to check out Yaron, I would imagine. And where else is Yaron going? Yaron's going to Switzerland. He's going to Poland. He just recently was in St. Petersburg, Russia, which was a big deal, given that is where Ayn Rand was born. So he took Ayn Rand's legacy back to her birthplace, which is pretty incredible. So Yaron's on the road. Yaron's in Europe. And I will be filling in for him. My name, again, is Rituparna Basu. I work at the Ayn Rand Institute, but I don't work in Southern California, where Yaron usually broadcasts from. We're actually broadcasting today from Alexandria, Virginia, which is in the D.C. area. One note about today's show, we won't be taking calls, so sit back and enjoy. Okay, so what are we talking about today? What should we talk about today? We should talk about healthcare. Mikey says we should talk about healthcare. I'm glad you said that, Mikey, because that's what I have on my notes here. So that is what we will be talking about. We would have been talking about even if you would have said something else. Okay, so what I do want to talk about today, we won't just talk about healthcare issues. We'll talk about some other things as well. But I do want to start out by talking about a really hot controversy right now, and that is the issue of these prescription drug prices. Have you heard about this, Mikey?
I have.
You've heard about this, right? These drug prices, they're super, super expensive. You have brand new drugs coming out, and they're super expensive. You have generic drugs all of a sudden have become really expensive, even though they're off patent. And it's a big controversy today. It's a big issue. And I want to talk about it, not just because other people are talking about it, but because it's a really important issue to understand. At the Ayn Rand Institute, I focus on healthcare policy. I focus on the growth of government intervention in healthcare. And if you step back and you look at the last 50 years, you've had increasing government intervention in the healthcare industry. And one aspect of it that hasn't been significantly touched, one aspect of it that hasn't been as significantly regulated as other areas, is pharmaceutical pricing. And so this is next. This is on the agenda. We have a lot of government intervention in healthcare, and this is one area where there's less of it, and we're going to see more of it in the coming years, and that conversation is already happening today. So if we want to stop this, if we want to roll back the growth of government in healthcare, if we want to move towards freedom, which I'm certainly an advocate for, Yaron is an advocate of, I said advocate for. We got a message the other day, actually, from a listener saying, why do we always say advocate for something? You're an advocate of something, grammatically speaking. So Yaron is an advocate of freedom in medicine, and I am also an advocate of freedom in medicine. And if you are too, then we have to fight going on with prescription drug prices in this country and what the left is saying we need to do about it. So let's take a short break here, and then we'll dive right into it.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
All right, we're back. You're listening to the Yaron Brooks Show. I'm Ritu Parna Basu, filling in for Yaron today. So we'll be talking today about the high price of prescription drugs. And this has become a controversy, a huge controversy recently. I think it's been a big issue. It's been a growing issue over the last few years. But right now it's really receiving a lot of attention. And even in, for example, the presidential debates, the issue has come up, even in the Republican debates. And the Republicans usually do not address this issue. It's really an issue that is on the radar of the left because they've made it an issue. But now even the Republicans feel like they have to have something to say about it. So it's a growing issue. And you might have seen this. I mean, in the headlines, just a few months ago, less than a few months ago, maybe a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, there was this guy, and he was the most hated guy in America for maybe a few weeks. He purchased the rights to this drug, an old drug, a drug that has been off patent for a while. It's called Daraprim. It's a drug that treats a parasitic infection, particularly in people with HIV, for example. And this drug used to be very cheap. It used to be $13.75 for one tablet, one pill. And this guy took that drug, acquired the rights to that drug, and raised the price to $750 for a tablet. And this caused so much rage. I mean, like I said, he was named one of the most hated men in America by several news publications. I did not make that up myself. He was really evil and a villain. And there have been less, perhaps, I mean, this was a very, very big topic or a big case, but this has been going on for some time, not just with generics, but you have all of these new drugs coming out, all of these new drugs that are coming down the pipeline, new classes of drugs. It's a very exciting time right now in biotechnology, in biopharmaceuticals, a lot of exciting products coming out of the pipeline. So you had, for example, this drug called Sovaldi. Mikey, have you heard of Sovaldi?
No.
You haven't heard of Sovaldi? Okay, let me tell you about Sovaldi then. And by the way, I should introduce Mikey. I realize that I've been referring to him, and not everybody knows him as well as I do. So just to give you a little bit of a picture of Mikey, Mikey works here at the Ayn Rand Institute with me. He is in charge of all of our social media efforts and involved in marketing efforts. And he is being so gracious as to help me host this show from the logistical point of view, because I don't know how to get the commercials going or any of that thing kind of thing. So Mikey is here in the room with me, so he gets to see this, hear this all in the room. It's exciting. So Sovaldi is this brand new drug that came out, I think it was last, I think it came out last year. Might have been 2013, but I'm pretty sure it was last year. And it is a revolutionary drug. If you know anything about this drug, it's a revolutionary drug. It treats hepatitis C, and treats is a small word. It actually cures hepatitis C. So you have millions of Americans who have hepatitis C, and hepatitis C is a virus that wreaks havoc on your liver. It's not a fun thing to have. And before Sovaldi came out, and the company that brought it to market is called Gilead Pharmaceuticals, and before they brought this drug to market, hepatitis C was one of those diseases that you just had to live with. You could try to manage it a little bit, but you had to just live lifelong with this disease. And they came out with this drug that actually cured people of this disease. And you could get rid of hepatitis C. You could be hepatitis C free, and you could go on and live the rest of your life, and it's no longer an issue for you. Pretty remarkable thing. But this drug caused a lot of controversy because it is $1,000 for one pill. So if you want to take the full regimen, that's going to cost you $84,000, which I get that. That's super expensive. I do not have $84,000 lying around. Do you, Mikey?
No,
Mikey doesn't either. Mikey doesn't either. People were very, very upset. People were very shocked that how can this drug be so expensive? How could they price it in such a way that it seems like it's out of the reach of a lot of people? What's going on here? And, you know, the company that came out with this drug is actually quite bold, because a little while later, they actually came out with another drug called Harvoni, which does the same thing as Sovaldi, but it does it faster, cures you of hepatitis C faster. And they actually charged $94,000 for that. So very, very expensive drugs. And part of the issue is, and part of the reason people are very concerned, is that a lot of the new drugs that are coming out, they're not drugs that are for a small subset of the population. You know, they're not specialty cancer drugs that only a few people will need. These are drugs that are targeted at a huge segment of the population. You have new classes of drugs coming out treating high cholesterol, an issue that so many Americans deal with. And so these as a whole are very, very expensive drugs that a lot of people are going to have to figure out, well, how are we going to pay for these drugs, or how are government programs going to pay for them, or how is the insurance company going to pay for them? That's a conversation. And so that's part of why there's a lot of controversy, that this seems unsustainable, unmanageable. These new cholesterol drugs, for example, around $14,000 a year. So not as much as Sovaldi, not $84,000, but, you know, cholesterol drugs you have to take over a longer period of time. You don't just take it for a few weeks and then you're cured or anything like that. So this is an issue. Now, if you step back a little bit, right, my basic perspective on this, when I hear this whole controversy that we're so mad that we have expensive prescription drugs out there, that they're so expensive and people are super, super mad about it, And they're so mad. I mean, when Hillary Clinton tweeted about how this was outrageous, that this guy had raised the price of a generic drug from $1,350 to $750. I mean, she tweeted that this was unacceptable, that this was price gouging. And the biotech tanks, the biotech stocks tanked. They totally tanked, and they haven't recovered since. And so it's whatever people are saying is having a huge impact. But if you step back and you think, does it make sense that we are so upset about expensive drugs? If you step back, does that make sense? And in one sense, I think, I am as astonished at the amount of controversy that this has created. I'm astonished at the controversy that these high prices have created. So leave aside generic drugs for a moment. Just leave those aside. Let's just think about the drugs that are brand new, the drugs that are revolutionary, drugs like Sovaldi that cure hepatitis C, drugs like the cholesterol drugs that are actually, they have the potential to reduce cholesterol in people, bad cholesterol in people that traditional statins like Lipitor have not been successful in helping these people. These sorts of drugs, is it a surprise that they're very expensive? Now, I think if you know some basic economics, you can see, no, it's not really surprising that these drugs are so expensive, right? Anything that is brand new, anything that is revolutionary, anything that hasn't been done before will be very expensive when it first comes out, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of resources, it takes a lot of effort to produce something for the first time. And once you learn how to do all of that, producing it a second time becomes easier, and producing a third time becomes even easier, and producing it a fourth time might be that you figure out how to more efficiently produce what you're producing, more cheaply produce it, and you learn all sorts of things. So over time, what you see is that prices go down. Think about early computers, early PCs. Early PCs cost around $50,000, which today would be around $400,000 if you account for inflation. $50,000 for early personal computers. And that's huge. That's a lot of money. If that's what it costs today, I wouldn't be able to afford it. A lot of people wouldn't be able to afford it. Mikey, I'm not going to ask you every time. Mikey, do you have $50,000? I'm not going to ask you that. I'm just going to say... I'm just going to say, you know, very expensive. But it made sense because creating the first personal computer took a lot of effort. People didn't know how to do it. Everything was expensive to do, and it's expensive. Today, look at how much cheaper personal computers are. A good personal computer you can get, a decent one at least, you can get for $500. If you think about something else, if you think about in the healthcare field, something like getting your genome sequenced, going through your DNA and sequencing all of that and figuring out, are you at risk for developing certain diseases? What does your future look like in terms of the medical situations that you will encounter? Genomic sequencing initially cost millions of dollars. And today, it's much cheaper. I mean, today you have companies like 23andMe, which, you know, you can just give that as a Christmas present. Hey, you know what? Why don't you go and get get yourself sequenced, and you can find out if you're at risk for Alzheimer's and diabetes and all sorts of things, and it's a great thing. So over time, the price of things come down. And when they first come out, they're expensive. That's just a normal trend of technology. And these new drugs that are coming out, these brand new classes of drugs, when you say classes of drugs, a class of a drug, if you come out with a new class of a drug, it means you're coming out with something totally new, a totally new type of dealing with a certain type of disease. Of course, this is going to be super, super, super expensive. Now, the point here isn't that, well, it should be $84,000 exactly. The point isn't that it should be $84,000 or $82,000 or $80,000 or $60,000. But the point is that on average, you would expect these sorts of drugs to be expensive. Sovaldi, for example, took 15 years to develop it, to test it, to bring it to market. Of course, something like that is going to be very expensive. And then if you take into account, right, if you take into account all of the other factors that are actually driving up the price of drugs in this country, then it's even less astonishing that about the fact that they're really expensive. Of course, they're going to be really expensive. There's all of these other factors that are involved. Factors such as the FDA. I mean, regulatory costs are a cost of business. They raise the cost of doing business. The FDA is a giant regulatory bureaucracy, imposes a lot of red tape on these companies, very, very onerous regulations. And that's not something we're going to talk about today in terms of what the FDA should and should not be doing. In my perspective, they shouldn't exist. But the fact is you have regulatory costs pushing up the cost of these drugs, and these regulatory costs are increasing. It can now take over $1 billion to get a drug to market. And part of that is the FDA requires a lot of things that it's red tape. Other factors, pushing up the price of drugs, that makes it not surprising that brand new drugs are super, super expensive. You know, when you discover a molecule, when you discover a new molecule, when a drug company discovers a new molecule, they have to file a patent for that. Once they identify that molecule, they have to file a patent. And the clock starts ticking on when their patent will expire from the moment they discover that molecule and they file for a patent. And it can take 10 to 12 years to get a drug from that initial discovery phase to the market. It can take 10 to 12 years. So realistically, most drug companies have 8 to 10 years. You got 20 years, so 10 to 12 years are already gone. You're developing that drug, you're testing that drug, you're getting it through FDA approval, all of that. You have 8 to 10 years to basically make money on this drug. 8 to 10 years. I mean, that's not a lot of time. I read an article today, and they were comparing this, the patent situation with drugs, to something like Disney having ownership over the rights to Mickey Mouse. And they've had that forever. And that's fine. They should. I'm not saying that they shouldn't. They should. But the point is you have these really, really expensive drugs that drug companies are producing, and they have 8 to 10 years in which they can make money off that. That is going to, of course, mean they're going to have to charge a lot in that time to recoup their investment. To recoup all that intellectual capital that went into producing it. Because what happens after the patent expires? After the patent expires, everybody knows how to make it, and then they go and produce this drug. And the actual production of that pill is not very expensive. What was expensive was figuring out exactly what goes into that pill, figuring out all the different failures, all the different ways that they failed first. All those failures have to be paid for. All of those things that companies that are producing generic drugs don't have to pay for, but those costs have to be recouped. And drug companies who produce these drugs have very little time to recoup. So that is going to put an upward pressure on these prices. Another factor, right? We talked about two factors that are driving up the price of these prescription drugs. Regulatory state, losing their patent in a very short amount of time. And another big one is the fact that every other country, every other advanced country, controls the price of their drugs. The government controls the price of the prescription drugs in those countries. So the takeaway from that is these countries are not paying market prices for the same drugs. So Sovaldi costs $84,000 here. That is not what it costs in the United Kingdom. That is certainly not what it costs in all the other countries. And it's varying levels. I think in Britain it might be around 60. I don't know the exact figure on that. But they're not paying market prices in those other countries because those other countries have said, the government has said, no, if you're going to sell a drug in this country, guess what? We're going to be able to decide the price of that drug. It's not going to be a market decision. It's not going to be a market price. It's going to be the government at the table, either directly or indirectly, pressuring these prices down, trying to get these drugs for less. And the impact of that, the impact of a drug company knowing that, look, Germany is only willing to pay so much for this drug. Well, guess what? Then who is going to eat those research and development costs? Who is going to pay for them? The United States is going to pay for them. The United States is subsidizing R&D for the rest of the world. And we subsidize it in part by overpaying for these drugs. We overpay for Sovaldi because other countries are not willing to pay the market price for Sovaldi. So where does Gilead Pharmaceuticals or any drug company go to try to recoup its investment? It goes to the United States where we don't control the price of drugs. So that is in a big way driving up the price of prescription drugs in this company. And by the way, I mean, as a side note, right, you hear a lot about other countries that, look, they spend less on healthcare. Yeah, they spend less on healthcare because the government controls the price of drugs. The government controls the price of treatments. The government controls what doctors and hospitals can charge. They're not super efficient in these other countries. It's just the government refuses to pay above a certain amount. So that's not a good thing, and that's a discussion for another day. But when people idolize other countries and they say they spend less, just that the government says, no, we're not going to pay. We're going to make other people pay. We're going to make Americans pay for these drugs, a big portion of the cost of these drugs. That's all that's happening. It's just free riding. So that's not a good thing. So it should, given all of this, I think one perspective is, of course, new drugs that are coming out today are going to be expensive. And that doesn't mean that you sit back and you think, okay, well, we just have to take all of this. We just have to accept all of this. No, a lot of what I've talked about is something you don't have to accept, right? The FDA's regulations should be challenged. Things that don't make sense, regulations that don't make sense, should be on the table that we need to get rid of them because they have real costs. And one of those costs is that they raise prices. There's other costs, too, with FDA regulations. I mean, there's the fact that now they are delaying when these drugs can get to market, which means people who could be benefiting from these drugs have to wait longer for relief from whatever is ailing them. But FDA regulations, we need to go after them. We need to investigate them. We need to get rid of things that don't work. And really, I think we need to have a conversation in this country about why we need the FDA, because I don't think we need it. I don't think it makes us safer. I think it actually has a lot of bad effects. But that's one thing we could be doing, because FDA regulations certainly drive up the price of prescription drugs. Another thing to do is look into this whole patent situation. I'm not here saying, well, look, this is how long a drug company should enjoy a patent. The point isn't to figure out what that exact number is, but there is a conversation to be had, I think, as to what is informing our decision on the patent issue. And it's very much the case that most people view patents, right, that a drug company has a patent. It's not a it doesn't get that market exclusivity based on what they have done. It gets that market exclusivity because we think we as a society are giving you a gift. We are giving you a gift that you get this patent, you get this market exclusivity, but it's a gift, and it has terms, and it has limitations, and at some point, this gift is going to end. We're going to end it. You're not going to get this market exclusivity anymore, this favor that we're bestowing upon you to keep you kind of happy and content and keep you producing so that you don't just get up and, you know, don't stop looking into and researching other drugs. New drugs, it's a gift. It's a gift. That whole perspective on looking at patents, I think, is wrong. I think it's wrong, and I think it's completely backwards. Because the whole premise of patents becomes, well, what's really, really important is that you've created a great drug. A drug company's come out, you've discovered a really promising molecule, and the whole guiding thought behind it is, well, we need to make sure that this gets off patent as quickly as possible so that everybody can get it, they can get it cheaply, and that's the kind of focus. How do we get this drug, how do we get everything about this drug out there so everybody can start producing it? That's really the goal. And so then they come up with a number. Okay, what should that number be? 20 years? Okay. Let them have market exclusivity for 20 years, even though half of that time they won't actually be able to sell the drug because it won't even have gotten to market. What should be, I think, the way to think about it, and I think if you thought about it this way, you could probably come up with a number that's different from the number we have today, is what has this person's work, right? This company that filing for this patent, what exclusivity has their work objectively earned them? What has it earned them? The fact that they have produced it, they have a certain right to that. What is it exactly they have a right to? How long does it make sense for them to have a right to that thing? And those are hard questions. Those aren't easy questions, and you need legal scholars to weigh in on that. But that's the perspective, that this is something that a drug company has produced. Gilead has produced Sovaldi. All right, it's clearly brought into existence a value that did not exist before. And they have a right to that. And what exactly does that right look like? We can have a conversation about that. But that is the perspective by which we should be approaching these issues. We shouldn't be approaching patents from the perspective of, look, this is a gift we're giving. Gilead produces Sovaldi, and obviously Sovaldi should belong to everybody. But we don't want to disincentivize Gilead from producing more drugs in the future. So for a little while, we'll throw them a bone and we'll let them have market exclusivity. But then after that, it's ours again. So that whole field, I think, that whole area needs to be thought of and challenged. And I think if you thought about it better, you would have a longer amount of time that drug companies could have to recoup their investments. And that way, I think you would see an impact on prices, and I think you would see prices go down. And then lastly, the issue of the price controls in other countries, that other countries are not willing to pay the price of innovation. A drug comes out, it's super expensive. It needs to be super expensive because it took so much to produce it. And these countries are saying, we're not going to pay those costs. That has to be dealt with because that is very, very unfair to Americans. So we have to subsidize everybody else, that everybody else is free riding off of us. That we should be paying the price of these drugs, but we shouldn't be paying more than what we should be paying because other people refuse to pay what they should be paying. And this is a complicated issue, but at the very least, right, what we should be doing, and I do not see this enough, and I wish that we would see it more, and I'll talk a little bit more about why we don't, but we need to be morally shaming these other countries because what they are doing is morally shameful. These great drugs are coming out. They're obviously benefiting a lot from these drugs. Sovaldi is going to benefit someone in Britain just as much as it's going to benefit someone in America, right? If you have hepatitis C, it's an issue for you wherever you are. So you're getting the same benefit, but you are not willing to pay the full price. As a country, as a society, as a culture, you have said, no, we're not going to pay this. And that's morally shameful. You should be willing to pay the full price of drugs and treatments that you are benefiting from. You should be willing to pay that. And you certainly shouldn't. So you're not only just shafting drug companies, but you're kicking the bill. You're kicking the bill over to Americans. And that they should be called out for. That is not good. You should pay for what you consume in life. You should pay for the things that you're consuming. You shouldn't punt the bill to other people. And you shouldn't, your perspective should be you're paying your way through life. And so that whole aspect, I mean, if we made an effort to getting other countries to change their policy, I mean, that would be a big deal for us here. That would lower our prices. So there's some sensible ways to go about this issue. Sensible ways to go about this issue of drug prices being very expensive. New drug prices, for example, being very expensive. But what is telling, I think, what is really telling, right, is that the people who are making this an issue in this country, and I would put that broadly as the left, the people who are making this a controversy, they don't seem to care very much about any of those things. They don't seem to care very much about the fact that the regulatory state in this country and healthcare is one of the most regulated industries in the United States. Even before Obamacare, that was the case. They don't seem to care very much that regulations are driving up the cost of drugs in this country, and that's something we can work on, and we can try to get better on, and we could try to deregulate, and that will be a good thing. They don't seem to care about those issues. Or the fact that the patent, the time that these companies have to recoup their investment, that is something that can be worked on, because does that really make sense that it's so short? That is something that they don't seem to care very much about. Their prescription, always, always, right? Their prescription is we need to get more government intervention. We need to get the government to regulate pharmaceutical pricing. We need government in there. In every way possible, we need to get the government into this, making the decisions, overriding the decisions of these pharmaceutical companies. Their prescription is big government. And it's telling. It's telling. And what it tells us is what they're really motivated by. What about this issue? High drug prices, expensive drug prices. What about it really upsets them? Because it's not what they usually say is what really upsets them. And I think there's reasons why they don't say what's really upsetting them. But what about this issue really is upsetting them that they seem to want to ignore, right? They seem to want to ignore sensible ways of dealing with a real issue, which is, that drugs are being overpriced. In a sense, they have to be very expensive because they're brand new. But there's also all these ways in which they're being unnecessarily inflated. And why don't we do something about that? What is going on there? What's their real issue? Let's take a break right now, and then we'll come back, and then we'll go into that.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates, They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
And we're back. You are listening to the Yaron Brooks Show. This is Rituparna Basu. By the way, you can follow me on Twitter. I encourage that you do that. I always love more followers. You can follow me at Basu Rituparna. So basically my last name and my first name. And if you can't spell that, that is B as in ball, A-S-U, R-I-T as in Tom, U-P-A-R-N-A, at Basu Rituparna. Follow me there. You can keep up with my work, and we can just keep talking. If you have questions, you can send those to me there. Just as a reminder, we're not taking live calls today. But if you do have a question, definitely hit me up on Twitter later. I love responding. I love having conversations on Twitter. It's fun. It's a fun time. Okay, so we were talking about why drugs are expensive, why prescription drugs are in the United States. And in part, right, we talked about that anything new is at first expensive, anything revolutionary, anything breakthrough, just like the first personal computer, just like genomic sequencing when it first became available. Everything is really, really expensive. So the fact that we have an $84,000 drug, a drug that cures a disease that had never previously been cured, a drug that can do that in very quickly, I believe Sovaldi works in, I think it's 8 to 12 weeks. The fact that exists, of course, it'll be very expensive. And over time, in a market at least, in a free market, what you see with new technology is that over time, the price comes down. Personal computers are much cheaper today, and genomic sequencing is much cheaper today. And you would expect the same thing of pharmaceuticals if we did indeed have a free market. And I recognize, of course, that in healthcare, we do not have a free market, and that will distort things. But that is the general trajectory of technology. In the beginning, it is expensive, and that is exactly what is happening with these drugs. Yet there's so much controversy and there's so much opposition, particularly from the left, as to why these drugs are so expensive and what the government needs to do to make these drugs cheaper. And there's not a lot of options on the table besides in some form using government coercion to control these prices, using government coercion to get these drugs for cheaper. But and we talked about how there's some sensible things that we could be doing, right? Sensible things that don't involve more government intervention. Sensible things that actually involve less government intervention. Things like deregulating the very, very difficult, burdensome, onerous, lengthy FDA review process that all of these drug companies must abide by to get their drugs on the market. There's sensible things that can be done. But this is not usually what's on the table. These are not the solutions put forth. It is government coercion that's put forth. Another way to see this is, you know, if none of the issues that I had mentioned, if the FDA didn't exist, if there weren't a lot of regulatory costs, if the patent process and the patents that these companies enjoyed for their products, if they weren't so short, right, if they didn't have just 8 to 10 years to recoup their costs, or if other countries weren't controlling the price of their drugs, which makes us overpay, if they weren't doing that. Even if all that stuff wasn't the case, you know, the left would still be attacking the price of these drugs. The left would still be attacking the price of these drugs. Even if Sovaldi was a little bit cheaper, it would still be attacking the price of these drugs. And they would be doing so, I think, because they have a problem. They have a big problem with these drug companies themselves. They have a big problem with what these drug companies are doing, with what they're all about. They have a much bigger problem that is coloring their opposition to these high prices. And it's really, in a sense, almost, you know, these expensive drugs are kind of masking what is really bothering people on the left, really bothering them, really getting them riled and getting them hungry for more government intervention. And I think you could see this very clearly. It was very much, very openly displayed at the Democratic presidential debate. This was, I guess, a few weeks ago now. We have so many of these debates that I can't keep track, but I think that there's only been one Democratic debate so far, and that's the one I'm talking about. And one of the questions that the moderators asked was, I think, a very good question, because it really, to me, was a soul-revealing question. It revealed something about your soul. It revealed something about, just really about you as a person. And the question that was posed to the candidates, and at that time I think there were five people on the stage, now it really just seems it's a competition between Hillary and Bernie. But the question that was posed was, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here, but in your time in political office, you have made a lot of enemies of people. Who are you most proud of that you've made an enemy of? Who are you most proud to have made an enemy of? You know? And, you know, if someone asked me that question, I mean, I don't know. I'd probably say Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. I'm not sure. I mean, someone really, really evil. There's a lot of evil people out there and a lot of evil groups out there. But that's probably something what I would say. Some foreign aggressor, I think. Or a domestic aggressor, but foreign aggressor probably is what I would go for. But, you know, what Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders said was who they were most proud to make an enemy of was the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry. And I'm just watching that, and I'm thinking, and nobody really questioned them on this. I mean, they're all saying insane things anyway, but nobody really questioned them on this, even the next day. And the Republicans certainly didn't go after them. And nobody really seemed to think this was a big deal, which in itself is a problem, right? It's itself pretty revealing. But think about that. You're proud to make an enemy of the industry, of the men and women who spend their lives, their time, their productive efforts making the drugs and the treatments that have made us all so much healthier, that have made us all so much productive, that are keeping many of us alive. That is who your enemy is? That is who you're proud to be an enemy of? That is soul revealing, I think. That is ugly. That is just like the people who created Sovaldi. Before Sovaldi, you had to live with hepatitis C. They create this great drug, and you are proud of making an enemy of those people? I mean, it's ugly, and it's enormously unjust. Enormously unjust towards these companies, towards these people who are creating amazing products, who represent the best among us, the best among us, doing something so amazing that benefits so many people. And that's who you consider an enemy. You know, and before you say, well, look, I want to point out, they weren't saying, look, there's some bad actors. There's always bad actors, right? There's always bad apples, a couple of rotten apples. They weren't saying, well, look, there's a couple of rotten apples in the pharmaceutical industry, and that's been a big problem, and we've had to go after them, and I'm proud of that. No, it was the whole pharmaceutical industry. As such, they have a problem with, a huge problem with, a problem with, and they're going to do something about it, and they're proud that they have a problem with these people. That was revealing. And it revealed, what is this problem? What is their problem with these drug companies that ostensibly are going out there and producing all of the things that are keeping us alive? It can be baffling in a sense. It can just be baffling. I mean, if you had like aliens looking over on Earth, right, and they're seeing all of this stuff and they see, you know, they see ISIS, and then they see a drug company, and they see Hillary Clinton saying, look, it's really, you know, the drug company that's evil. I mean, it's insane. It's like, are you seeing reality? Are you seeing the real threats in the United States today? So what is behind this attitude? It's a little perplexing of an attitude in a sense. What's coloring it? Why are they such a big, why are they enemies? Why is the left? And I'm going to put here, okay, Hillary and Bernie are representatives of the left, okay? They're huge representatives of the left. They're the face of the left right now. Why do they hate pharmaceutical companies so much? It's not a huge secret, right? It comes out here and there, which is that, look, these companies are trying to make a profit. They are trying to make money. And that is a no-no. That is a no-no when it comes to medicine. In today's culture, it's a no-no in general, right? The fact that you are thinking about your bottom line, that's enough of a reason in today's culture to view you with suspicion. Think about how much we view with suspicion the financial industry. I mean, very, very suspiciously, because people see, look, they're in it to make money, and they get all sorts of blame and they get all sorts of vilification because they are after making money. And in healthcare, you're not supposed to be in it to make money. You're not supposed to be in it to make money. You're supposed to be in it to serve people, to meet people's needs, to put other people first. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can put it. If you're out there and you're trying to make money in healthcare, in the pharmaceutical industry, then that is something very suspicious about you. And guess what? Drug companies are in it to make money. They're all for-profit companies. They have investors, okay? They have stocks. I mean, they are clearly driven by financial motives. And that is at odds with what people think they really should be about, that they really shouldn't be about profits, right? That they really shouldn't. No one is saying, and I don't think anybody would say, look, a drug company shouldn't be able to recoup its costs, its production costs. People don't say that. But what they do have a problem with is, well, okay, after you recoup your production costs, then what? Then how much money should you be able to make? How much profit should you really be making off of this drug? And this is an obvious part of why drugs are expensive, right? It's not just that Sovaldi is $84,000 because it took 15 years to produce it because it was the first time they're producing it because there are regulatory costs and all sorts of other issues involved. Those are not the only things behind the decision to price Sovaldi at $84,000. There's another aspect of it is, look, they're trying to make money off of this drug. They're trying to sell you this drug for more than what it took them to produce it. That's obviously happening. And the left has a huge problem with it. And I wish, you know, because I can say it. I can go out and I can say it, and I do. Part of my job is to go out, talk to students, talk to congressional staffers, talk to businessmen, talk to all sorts of people, and talk to them about why it's okay and why it's moral to pursue a profit in healthcare. I can go and I can talk about it. But I wish that the people who are actually making these drugs, the people who are the target of these attacks, would go out there and at least forget about defending themselves, at least admit what everybody else already knows. Which is, yeah, they are motivated in large part by money. They are motivated in large part by doing well financially. And they don't. People don't come out and say this. I mean, even the guy we talked about in the beginning, the guy who raised the price of a drug, an off-patent drug, from $1,350 a tablet to $750. I think the company's name is called Turing Pharmaceutical. Even he's the most hated guy in America at the time, right? And even he says that people clearly are just, they hate this guy. And he comes out there and he says, yeah, but you know what? I'm charging high prices because I'm going to put it into R&D. And it's like, are you serious? Are you serious? Like, are we supposed to take you seriously? Obviously, you are trying to make money. It's not that you're not going to put anything in R&D. I'm sure you will. You probably will, because this drug is probably not the only thing that'll keep you going. You probably need more products. That's true. But clearly, there's a financial motive here. And People don't admit this. The producers, the drug companies don't admit this, which makes them look even more guilty, more suspicious, right? Because it's, everybody knows that's what they're after. Everybody knows that's an important factor in their decision-making about how much these drugs should cost. Everybody knows that. Yet here they are pretending like that's not what's going on at all, that really they're motivated by research and development. I mean, that is the stock response, right, to anybody who says, well, look, we don't want price controls in drugs in the United States. It's going to hurt R&D. It's going to hurt innovation. It's 100% true it's going to hurt innovation. It's 100% true it's going to hurt R&D. No doubt about that. You have to say that. But that's not going to do it. You can't just say that because people care about something else more than they care about innovation. They care about living in a society where things are right, where people are acting in moral ways, that things are set up in a way to reward the people who are being morally proper. And if a drug company is seen as being morally improper, proper by pursuing profit, that is going to bother people so much that it doesn't matter that their innovation is going to be sacrificed. I mean, look at these other countries who have the price controls in drugs. All of them have it. It's 100% clear that is terrible for innovation, right? It's not a surprise that the United States, which doesn't control prices, why the United States is the leader in biopharmaceutical research. It's not a surprise. It's not a big leap to say, if you control prices in the United States, guess what? Innovation here will suffer as well. And then where are we all going to go? Where are we going to look to, right? Everybody else, all the other countries, free ride on us. Once we also start controlling prices and impeding innovation, where will everybody go? All right. But people don't care about that as much as you might think that they care about. No, they really are bothered, knowing all of that, that in the United States, drug companies can still pursue profit and pursue it unabashedly. So I wish these drug companies would come out there and say, because what they're doing is actually good. What they're doing is actually proper. They should be pursuing a profit. They should be pursuing it. They should be pursuing it proudly, and they should be telling everybody that, yes, this is what we're doing, and we're proud to do it, and it's you who don't have the moral high ground here. It's you who are wrong here. It's you who's putting out an immoral idea. To be moral in healthcare is to want to make money in healthcare. And let me say a little bit more about this. Why is it a good thing, right? Why is it a good thing to seek profit in healthcare, to seek a profit? Our whole culture, and, you know, if you want to read more about this, I mean, obviously I'll understand this more. I mean, you have to read Ayn Rand because this is what she spent her whole life talking about. But our whole culture is dominated by an ideology or a philosophy that glorifies win-lose situations, that glorifies win-lose engagements, that I win and you lose. You're supposed to always lose. You're supposed to always sacrifice. Sacrifice is considered the meaning of morality. All right? These drug companies are supposed to be losing. They're supposed to be giving us stuff, drugs that we need, and they're not supposed to be getting anything out of that because our whole culture glorifies win-lose relationships. It doesn't glorify win-win relationships. It often refuses to even acknowledge that win-win relationships can exist in a healthy way. If anything, they put it as somebody has to lose. It's not possible to have a win-win. If a drug company is making money, it's because it's doing something wrong. It's because it's stepping on its customers. It's because it's cutting corners. It's sacrificing quality. It's putting out unsafe stuff out there. That's what we think about. Somebody always has to lose. Pursuing a profit is all about pursuing win-win relationships. It's all about win-win. How do you make a profit? How do you make a profit? Like I said, people think it is that you step on other people, that you lie, that you cheat, that you try to get away with something. But profit isn't earned by that. You earn money. You get money. You convince people to give you money by creating something great that people are willing to pay for. And they're willing to pay so much for it that you make a lot of money doing it. That's how profit is created, by creating something awesome that people are willing to pay for, by creating a drug that cures a disease that previously was deemed, okay, well, we can't cure this. That's how you make money, by creating something great. And when you create something great, why should you be on the losing end? Why should patients get this great drug and the drug company not get something great in return? Why is that moral? Okay, and why is it immoral if the drug company also does well in the process? If the drug company also gets more out of it? What is wrong with that? That is right. That is what they deserve. Everybody deserves to have win-win relationships. No one deserves to be on the losing end of things, not if they don't have to be. And that's the glorification in today's culture, that these drug companies, there's something suspicious about it if they also want to do well by making these great drugs. There's something suspicious about that. No, there's nothing suspicious about that. That's what we should be encouraging people to do, and that is what they deserve. That is their much-earned payment for engaging in efforts that are keeping the rest of us alive. And in a market, right, it's not that when I say they should be getting a lot in return, it's not that you can charge arbitrarily in a market. It's not that, look, I came up with a drug, I'm going to charge $4 billion for it. That's the great thing about a market. A market is about objectivity. A market keeps things in check, right? So if you are arbitrary and you charge a ridiculous price that nobody's willing to pay, guess what? You're going to learn really fast and you're going to lower that price. But the market price is really an important concept. It's the price that people are willing to pay for this product, the price that it makes sense for the company, the producer, to charge this product at, that they can make money and customers are great, getting something great that they're willing to pay for, right? They're getting more in return than what they're paying. That's why they're choosing to pay this price. That is what that represents, the market price. And any attempt to subvert all that decision-making and all that judgment, that individual judgment that is going into a market price, any attempt to subvert that, to override that through price controls or any other sort of government intervention, it's all it's trying to do is put pharmaceutical companies in a losing position, in a losing position. The people who are producing these great drugs, put them in a losing position. And that is ugly, and it is backwards, and it is upside down. It is upside down. The whole attack on drug prices is rooted in the idea that drug companies shouldn't be gaining from the process, that we should be gaining as the patients. But no, they shouldn't be gaining. That is bad. That is suspicious. That is unethical. No, that's not unethical. That's the basis of ethics, that they should be making a lot of money off of things that are really amazing and clearly we all really, really need and want and value. So if you want to fight, right, if you want to fight, so this, I said in the beginning, this is the fight now. Government intervention in healthcare has been growing. Obamacare was the latest attempt, right, the latest step. It was even more government intervention in an industry that was already super regulated. And I'm being a little bit more vague about this, mostly for time issues. But if you want to know more about that whole trajectory and what that's looked like, I'd go to our website, ari.einrand.org, and we have a lot of material there where you can learn about it or you can tweet me. But this is the next step. And it's not just from the perspective of, look, everyone's talking about it, so it's the next step. But it is, if you look at other countries that do have way more socialized medicine than we do, and we do have socialized medicine in very important respects in this country. We do have it, not fully socialized, but we have significant aspects of it. But if you look at other countries that have full socialized medicine or have even more government intervention, which is basically every advanced country, you see that they all have controlled their drug prices. So it's only a matter of time. We look to those other countries. We say, hey, we haven't done this yet. We need to do it. And so that's what you're seeing now. And the whole driving factor behind it, right? We talked about this is part of, or we didn't talk about, but I'll say it briefly now, is the whole goal for the last 50 years the United States has been to have some sort of socialized medicine, has been to have some sort of universal healthcare, as they put it. And this fits right into it. This fits right into it because the whole push for socialized medicine, for universal healthcare, is a push motivated by a total denigration of the profit motive in healthcare, trying to get money out of healthcare, and on the notion that people are morally entitled to medical services that they cannot pay for. And so the drug price issue and the controversy, it's just the latest manifestation of those attitudes, particularly of the attitude that we don't like it when people make money in medicine. And look, all these drug companies are making money in medicine, and so we have to go after that, we have to regulate it, we have to stop that. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about drug prices and this growing controversy. And it is, you know, I said in the beginning that even the Republicans are starting to take on this issue, not as much as they need to. Most of what I've seen is they want to reform the FDA, which is fine. I'm not saying that I support any of their particular proposals, but yes, the FDA, there's a lot you can do there. But nobody, none of them have come out and said and defended the right of, the moral right of these drug companies to be pursuing profits and therefore to be charging prices that allow them to pursue a good amount of profit. Instead, they concede, as they most often usually do, to the left. They concede on this issue, on the moral issues, and they say, yeah, it's definitely wrong for a drug company to try to make as much money as it can, but we still shouldn't control the prices because it'll hurt innovation and things like that. So there's a lot of work that I think the right could be doing that can be better defending the pharmaceutical industry if they decide that is indeed what they want to do. But I'm not going to sit here and say that they necessarily do. I mean, we had Medicare Part D under a Republican, right? Medicare Part D is the greatest expansion of Medicare in 2003, giving seniors a guarantee that, look, all these drugs out there, all these pharmaceuticals, you will get those courtesy of the government. The government will pay for them, or pay a significant portion of them. So I'm not sure how much help the Republicans can be. Okay, so this is where I want to close this issue. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back. I want to end on a really cheerful note, a really happy note, talk about something totally different. I'm going to talk about the holiday season and why I love it and why I hope you love it, and we'll talk about that. All right, see you in a bit.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
And we're back with the Yaron Brook Show, our last segment. I'm Ritu Parnabasu. In this last segment, I want to talk about something else, something different from healthcare. I want to talk about the holiday season, the fact that it is upon us now, and why I love the holidays. I absolutely love them. I'm from India. I was born in India. And I immigrated to the United States when I was very young, when I was 5. So the holiday season, right, I guess the holiday season after, from Halloween to Christmas, it was a very unfamiliar custom, unfamiliar kind of situation for my family. When we first moved here, my parents, nobody knew what any of this stuff was. Certainly, my family parents did not know about Halloween. I was 5. I didn't know much of anything. But they didn't know about Halloween. They didn't know about Thanksgiving. And they knew Christmas existed, holiday. But they thought it was a Christian holiday where Christians go to church and all that kind of thing. And they didn't know how widespread it was in America. And they did not know, just the benevolence of it and the cheerfulness of it. They didn't know the spirit of Christmas. And so when we first moved here, they learned about it, particularly about Christmas, and they wanted to get on board. They thought the customs were nice. They thought the customs were sweet, particularly, that you have Santa Claus and he comes and he gives you presents and to the kids, and they thought it was cute. And so we started doing it, right? We started out with little stockings that they would hang for me and my sister, and we put little things in there. And that was the extent of us celebrating Christmas, that we would have these stockings and they would put little gifts in there, and we'd think Santa Claus was bringing them. And now, this was many years ago, now we're big Christmas people. I mean, we go all out. We have big trees and we decorate everywhere and we have lights and it's very important, and my whole family, my huge big family, gets together and we're big on Christmas. All of us are really big on Christmas. And I should say here that we're not Christian. My family isn't Christian. There's obviously Christians in India, but my family was not a Christian, is not Christian. They're Hindu. And we're all really into Christmas. And my husband, he grew up in a Jewish family. And even he now is really, really into Christmas. And it's a really important holiday for my whole family. And I think it's interesting to think about why. Because it's not, I don't think it's unique to my family. It's just, we never had any experience with Christmas. So it is interesting to think about. It's really important to us today and why it's so important. And it's interesting because, I don't think it has anything to do with the Christianity aspect of Christmas, because we're not Christian and we don't do any of the traditional Christian things that a lot of Christians do on Christmas. We don't go to church, for example, or that kind of thing. But it's so important, I think, to us, and it's so important, I think, to a lot of people, because Christmas is, in America in particular, right, is about so much more than Christianity. It's about so much more than religion. It's a very commercial holiday. It's a very commercial holiday. It's an intentionally commercial holiday. And I think that commercialization is what has made the holiday so special, so special to me, so special to a lot of people who did not grow up celebrating Christmas necessarily, who did not grow up in a Christian family, but it is nevertheless a very, very special holiday. It's an American holiday in that sense. I mean, just the benevolence and the cheerfulness of the holiday. When we first moved here, one of the things that my family was very impressed by is shopping malls. Because in India at the time, and we're talking, you know, in the early to mid-90s, there were huge shopping malls. We take them for granted here. And now there are huge shopping malls in India. But back then there weren't. And that was really amazing to be able to go, and there's a huge building, and there's all these stores, and you can just walk into any of them. Super convenient. And then, of course, during the holiday time, you know, they decorate them, and they go all out. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's just the most beautiful thing. And my family would take videos and we'd take pictures and we'd send them back to people in India and be like, look how beautiful this is in this country. Like, Christmas is such a big deal and everything is so beautiful. That all is an aspect of commercialization. I mean, just the decoration aspect, the decoration, the fact that we decorate the Christmas trees, we put these ornaments on the Christmas trees. The fact we do that because a company named Woolworths commercialized that, significantly commercialized that. Woolworths was a nickel and dime store. So we don't have those anymore. Now we have the dollar stores, but a similar version, right? The nickel and dime stores. And they started selling ornaments, Christmas ornaments, to the mass market because Christmas ornaments used to be very, very expensive. So most people could not afford them. And just that whole activity of decorating your Christmas tree. I mean, that's very, I love doing that. I absolutely love decorating the Christmas tree. Make it an activity. Put on good music, you know. It's a lot of fun. And that whole tradition, that whole kind of thing was significantly shaped by commercialism, by commercial efforts, by capitalism. Just the image of Santa, and this I think a lot of some people probably know, the image of Santa that we think of today, right? Santa as having this red coat, this white beard, a little plump with his boots. We think of Santa that way. That's the way Santa generally looks at every mall in America because that's the way Coca-Cola presented him. That's the way the Coca-Cola company presented him. It was in all of their ads. And that's why we think of Santa in that way. So the great parts about Christmas, the great parts that I think about Christmas, they come from this commercial aspect. The music. I love Christmas music. I know some people don't like Christmas music. They get tired of Christmas music. I'm one of those people who listens to Christmas music on that radio station. There's always one or two radio stations where they only play Christmas music. And I can understand that that might be excessive for some people. It's not for me. I love it. And even the gift-getting aspect. I love the gift-getting aspect. Do you get gifts for Christmas, Mikey?
Everyone.
No one gets you gifts. I get a lot of gifts. I'm very loved, apparently. No, but I love the gift-giving aspect. And people find it a little stressful, and it can be stressful, you know, but it also, it's a great way to show that you care for somebody. And that's, I mean, that's, it's a great thing. I love it. So I love Christmas. We didn't celebrate Thanksgiving very much in my family till recently. I think a few years ago we started celebrating Thanksgiving, but we got on the Christmas train really early when we came to America because we recognized this is really important to the culture of America. And if we want to be Americans, we should try to get in on this. And it was super fun. So who wouldn't want that? So I'll be enjoying my holiday season. And I don't think I'll be talking to you guys again. I don't think I'll be guest hosting again before the year's over. So I wish you a very, very happy holiday. Take care for the year on Brooks. I'm Ritu Parnabasu. I'll catch you guys later.